This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present Grey Sister, Second Book of the Ancestor by Mark Lawrence, narrated by Heather O'Neill. The story so far. For those of you who have had to wait a while for this book, I provide brief catch-up notes to Book 1. So that your memories may be refreshed, and I can avoid the awkwardness of having to have characters tell each other things they already know for your benefit. Here I carry forward only what is of importance to the tale that follows. You may find yourself wondering about Kiot when he is mentioned. You're supposed to wonder. You will find out. He's not mentioned in Book 1. Abath is a planet orbiting a dying red sun. It is sheathed in ice, and the vast majority of its people live in a 50-mile-wide ice-walled corridor around the equator. An artificial moon, a great orbiting mirror, keeps the corridor free of ice by focusing the sun's rays into it each night. When, thousands of years ago, the four original tribes of men came to Abath from the stars, they found the ruins of a vanished people they call the Missing. The Empire is bounded by the lands of the Skithrol to the east and by the Sea of Marn to the west. Across the sea, the Derns rule. At the end of Book 1, Dernish invaders were raiding inland from the coast. As the sun weakens, the ice continues a slow advance despite the warmth of the moon's nightly focus. As the corridor is squeezed, nations look to their neighbors for new territory. The Empire's nobility are the Sis. The suffix is attached to the name of ennobled families, for example, Taxis, Jotsis, etc. The four original tribes that came to Abath were the Geront, Hunska, Marjal, and Quantal. Their blood sometimes shows in the current population, conferring unique powers. The Geront grow very large. The Hunska are fantastically swift. The Marjal can manifest all manner of minor to medium magics, including shadow weaving, sigil writing, and mastery of elements. The Quantal can access the raw power of the path and manipulate the threads that are woven to create reality. The ships that brought the tribes from the stars were said to have been powered by ship hearts. A small number of these orbs exist within the Empire and are highly valued, as they enhance the magical abilities of Quantals and Marjals. The Missing left behind structures called arcs. Three exist within the corridor. The Emperor's palace is built around one. There are no reliable records of anyone being able to open the ark, but a faked prophecy predicts the coming of a chosen one who will be able to. Nona Grey is a peasant child from a nameless village. She was given to the child-taker Giljon, who sold her to the Kaltas, where ring fighters are trained and pitted against each other. Nona ended up at the Convent of Sweet Mercy, where novices are trained in service to the ancestor. Novices take orders as one of four classes of nun. Holy Sister, entirely religious duties. Grey Sister, or Sister of Discretion, trained in assassination and stealth. Red Sister, or Martial Sister, trained in combat. Holy Witch, or Mystic Sister, trained to walk the path. Nona has proven to be a triple blood, an incredibly rare occurrence. She has Hunska, Marjal, and Quantal skills. Nona has holy black eyes, a side effect from taking a dangerous antidote. She has no shadow, having cut it free while fighting Yisht. Yisht is a woman of the Ice Tribes and is in the employ of the Emperor's sister Sherzal. Yisht stole the Sweet Mercy ship heart and killed Nona's friend Hessa. Nona is hated by Lord Thurin Taxus, as she first wounded and later killed his son Raemal, a Geraint ringfighter. She is also hated by Thurin's surviving son Lano. The Taxus sent assassins known as Nói Gúin after Nona. Once hired, the Nói Gúin rarely cease their efforts until the target is dead, even if it requires years of patience. During the theft of the Shipheart, Nona was betrayed by her friend and fellow novice, Clara Gomel. Among Nona's remaining friends are novices Ara, Darla, Ruli, and Jula. Arabella Jotzis is from a powerful family and a rare two-blood, having both Hunska and Quantel skills. Darla is the daughter of an important officer in the Emperor's armies and has Geraint blood. Ruli has minor Marjal skills. Jula is very studious and hopes to become a holy sister. Zol is a significant novice. She is from the Ice Tribes and came to the convent at Shirzal's insistence, used as an unwitting distraction to help in the theft of the Shipheart. She is the only known Foreblood with access to all the skills of the original tribes. Many consider her to be the chosen one from prophecy. Under the prophecy, Zol is the Argatha, and Nona is her shield. The Convent of Sweet Mercy is led by Abbess Glass, a woman whose connections in the church and beyond reach further than expected. Most senior among the nuns are the Sister Superiors Wheel and Rose. Sister Wheel teaches spirit classes. Sister Rose runs the sanatorium. Other important figures are Sister Tallow, who teaches Blade, Sister Pan, who teaches Path, and Sister Apple, who teaches Shade. Sister Kettle is a grey sister based at the convent. She and Apple are lovers. There are four classes or stages that novices move through as they train to take holy orders as nuns. Red class, grey class, mystic class, and holy class. Book one ended with Nona in grey class, aged around 11 or 12. Novices take new names when they become nuns. Nona will become Sister Cage. Ara will be Sister Thorn. Book one ended with Nona having just killed Raemal Taxus in the wilds. Sisters Kettle and Apple were secretly watching over the novices, but Kettle was poisoned by a Nói Gúin assassin tracking Nona, and Apple has gone to her aid. Prologue. The dissolution of any monastery or convent is not something to be lightly undertaken. Even the might of House Taxus, whose line was born of emperors, may not suffice. Lano Taxus came to the Rock of Faith, garbed for war. His armor, arc steel, made bloody by the light of a thousand crimson stars. Before him, the serried ranks of his personal guard, the iron core of the Taxus army, forged by his father. Soldiers tempered in battles upon the Empire's eastern borders, and in the west, upon the beaches of the Marne. But Lano's confidence rested on more than the spears of his army. Nói Gúin walked with him, brought from the shadowed halls of the Tetragode. When a child is given to the Nói Gúin, it is sacrificed to the dark. Some few may survive the training, but the adult who then descends the fortress walls on a moonless stretch of night, a decade and more later, will be a different person. They will have been cut free of any allegiance to parent or sibling, pruned from the ancestor's tree. They will be Nói Gúin, instruments of death, beyond morality, beneath religion, dedicated only to the task they have been given. The richest among the Sis may purchase their services, but few missions require more than one child of the Tetragode. None living remember more than three acting together. Even the oldest stories never speak of more than five. Eight walked with Lanotaxus the day he came to the convent that stood upon the Rock of Faith. Nona Gray, you're sure? Lano raised his visor to squint at the dark figure standing alone in the path of his army, tiny before the great band of pillars. Sister Cage, return to sweet mercy. Fist smacked palm, gauntlets clashing. Oh, this is perfect. I feared she had gone despite my instructions. A glance to his left. It's her. You're sure? Clara Goma lifted her dark eyes to him. Of course. Which other would let me go? Sister Cage waited, shadowless among the shadows of the pillars. The old nuns and young novices watched from within the stone forest behind her. When the taxus came and the blood began to flow, Sister Rose would still be fighting her own battle somewhere back there, striving to save Sister Thorne from her injuries. Clara had left Thorne bleeding. She could have killed her in a moment. But she didn't. At least there was that. The sword Cage held offered its sharpness to the world, and the corridor wind, divided by its edge, hissed in pain. Cage's sister had waited for her battle, hunting her center, seeking silence and stillness while the Pilarthi advanced. Few Red Sisters had ever left the Convent of Sweet Mercy better able than Sister Thorne to practice what the mistresses of Blade and Path had taught them. Sister Cage walked to a different beat. The holy disdain anger, for what faith is not at its core, about acceptance of things you cannot change. The wise call wrath unwise, for few truths are to be found there. Those who rule us stamp upon rage, for they see it clearly, knowing it for the fire that it is, and who invites such hungry flames among that which they possess? To Sister Cage, though, fury was a weapon. She opened herself to the anger she had held at bay. Her friend lay dying. Her friend. There is a purity in rage. It will burn out sorrow, for a time. It will burn out fear. Even cruelty and hatred will seek shelter. Rage wants none of them, only to destroy. Rage is the gift our nature gives to us, shaped by untold years. Why discard it? Every law of church or state seeks to separate you from your anger. Every rule is there to tame you, to take from your hands that which you should own. Every stricture aims to place the vengeance that is yours in the grasp of courts, juries, justice, and judges. Books of law look to replace what you know to be right with lines of ink. Prisons and executioners stand only to keep your hands from the blood of those who have wronged you. Every part of it exists to put time and distance between deed and consequence, to lift us from our animal nature to cage and tame the beast. Sister Cage watched her enemy, bright in steel upon the rock. Hers, the anger of an ocean wave rolling over deep waters to spend its white fury against the shore, one and then the next, relentless, tearing down high cliffs, pounding rocks to pebbles, grinding pebbles to sand, and thus are mountains laid low. Hers, the storm's wrath, thunder-shaken, sharp with lightning, blown on a wind that rips the oldest trees from the hardness of the ground. Hers the defiance of stone, raised in outrage against cold skies. Hers the anger that sits like broken glass within a chest. The anger that will allow no sleep, no retreat, no compromise. Nona Gray raises her head and regards her foe through midnight eyes. Perhaps it is just the reflection of the torchlight, but somewhere, in their darkness, A red flame seems to burn. I am my own cage. She lifts her sword. And I have opened the door. Chapter 1. There are many poisons that will induce madness, but none perhaps quite so effective as love. Sister Apple carried 100 antidotes, but she had drunk that particular draught of her own free will, knowing there was no cure. Thorn and briar tore at her. The ice wind howled. Even the land opposed her with its steepness, with the long miles, the ground iron hard. The poisoner pressed on, worn, feeling each of her 30 years, her range coat shredded in places, the tatters dancing to please the wind. When the deer track broke from cover to cross a broad and rutted track, Apple followed without hesitation, eyes on the ranks of trees resuming their march on the far side.
Stop!
A harsh cry close at hand. Apple ignored it. Kettle had summoned her. She knew the direction, the distance, and the pain. Kettle had called her. Kettle would never call her from her watch, not even if her life were in danger. But she had called.
Stop!
More voices raised, the dialect sharp-angled and hard to attach meaning to. The tree line stood 10 yards away across a ditch. Once she reached the shadows beneath the branches, she would be safe. An arrow zipped past her. Apple glanced along the road. 5 Dernishmen spanned the width, their quilted armor salt-stained and mud-spattered. The iron plate sewn on shoulders and forearms brown with rust. Apple could reach the trees before the men caught her, but not before the next arrow or spear did. Cursing, she reached both hands into her coat pockets. Some of the obscenities she uttered had probably never been spoken by a nun before. Even the Dernishmen seemed surprised.
Don't kill me. I'm worth more to you alive.
Apple tried not to sound as if she were lecturing a class. She drew her hands out, a wax capsule of boneless in one, a wrap of grey mustard in the other, and a small white pill between finger and thumb. She popped the pill into her mouth, hoping it was bitterwill. She had all the antidotes ordered inside the many inner pockets of her habit, but reaching in to recover one would be asking to get shot. So she chanced to memory, feel, and luck, fishing in the outer pocket of her range coat.
You, a nun?
The tallest of them took a pace forward, spear leveled. He was older than the other 4, weathered.
Yes, a holy sister.
She swallowed the pill, grimacing. It tasted like bitterwill. The 4 younger raiders, all with the same dark and shaggy hair, tightened their grip on their weapons, muttering to pagan gods. Perhaps one nun in 100 was anything other than a holy sister, but with the stories told in Dern, they couldn't be blamed for thinking every woman in a habit was a red sister, or a holy witch just itching to blast them to smoking ruin. A nun? From the convent?
Convent?
The leader rolled the word around his mouth.
Convent.
He spat it past frost-cracked lips. Apple nodded. She bit back on her desire to say, with the big golden statue? The men had to walk into the trap themselves. If they sensed her leading them, she would be dead in moments. The leader glanced back at his men, gabbling out words that so nearly made sense. Dernish was like Empire tongue put through a mincer and sprinkled with spice. She had the feeling that if they would just speak a little more slowly and change the emphasis, it would all become comprehensible. Apple caught the 2 words that might keep her alive, though. Convent and gold. She broke the capsule of boneless in her fist and rubbed her fingers over her palm to spread the syrupy contents before wiping the hand over the back of her other and her wrist.
You, take us to convent.
The man advanced another 2 paces, gesturing with his spear for her to move.
I won't,
Apple tried to sound scared rather than impatient. She thought of Kettle in danger, injured maybe, and fear entered her voice.
I can't. It's forbidden.
She had to get them close. She couldn't do much if they prodded her ahead of them at the point of a spear. She let her gaze flit between the faces of the men, offering a wavering defiance. A defiance that they might enjoy breaking. The leader motioned and two of his men advanced to grab Apple's arms. A third kept his bow ready, half-drawn, arrow pointing her way, daring her to run. The last leaned on his spear, grinning vacantly. Apple feigned panic, raising her hands to intercept those that reached for her, but offering too little resistance to invite blows. One of the pair seemed to need no excuse and slapped her anyway, a hard, calloused hand across the face. She spat blood and cried out for mercy. Both men were smeared with the clear, boneless syrup now, sticky, on their fingers. The slapper twisted one arm behind her while the other made to open her coat, perhaps forgetting that the ancestors' brides take a vow of poverty. Knowing he would find her array of poisons and cures rather than any gold or silver, Apple wailed piteously, raising her clenched fist to remind them she had something more obviously hidden. Slapper grunted incomprehensible syllables to Robber, and the man abandoned the coat ties to pry Apple's hand open. In taking hold of it, he got a second dose of boneless wiped across the palm of his hand. With the bitter will to counter the poison, Apple felt only a numbness where the syrup coated her, the strength in her arms untouched. Apple began crying out, keeping her fist clenched against the robber's weakening efforts. Slapper tried to twist her into submission, and it hurt like fire, but she managed enough resistance to stop him breaking the arm behind her. At the same time, Apple threw herself left, then right, her progress always towards the leader and the archer, though she never once glanced their way. The Dern's hobnails slid on the mud. The remaining subordinates laughed uproariously at their comrade's efforts, making no move to help. The leader, snorting in disgust, motioned the archer forward, then jammed his spear butt into the mud and followed to intercept the group as they made a weaving approach. Neither Slapper nor Robber yet seemed to understand that they had been poisoned, presumably believing instead that Apple was an abnormally strong woman, perhaps drawing some animal strength from the depths of her terror. Apple wrenched her fist to her face as the officer reached them. She blew through her closed hand, a short, sharp puff, and a cloud of powder from the crushed wrap bloomed around the man's head. The edge of the cloud caught the archer just behind him. True terror loaned Apple the strength to throw herself backwards, falling from the Dern's clutches to the rutted mud. She had seen what grey mustard could do, and nothing in her array of antidotes would reduce the pain and disfigurement of it to an acceptable level. The officer's screams shattered the air, the breath for his second cry sucking mustard spores into his lungs. The archer fell back, scratching at his eyes. Slapper and Robber staggered away, tripping and stumbling, which left Apple, empty-handed, on the ground, with one able-bodied foe just yards away, spear in hand. Another person's distress exerts a certain fascination. The man stood in slack-jawed horror, watching the officer claw his face to ruin. Apple glanced at the shadows between the trees. So close. A quick scramble could see her safe in their embrace. The need to be speeding towards Kettle drew at her even more strongly than the desire to escape. But sisters of discretion swear more than just vows of piety and poverty. Suppressing an impatient snarl, Apple drew her knife. She rose slowly from the mud amid the officer's bubbling screams, the archer's curses, and the struggles of the other two Dernishmen trying and failing to get to their feet. Her headdress had come loose, and red hair spilled around her shoulders. The last of her coat ties gave, and her range coat opened about her like the dark wings of a raptor. She held her knife ready to throw, a pouch of ground Dedruff in the other hand in case she got the chance to take the spearman alive. The raider saw her at the last moment, dragging his gaze from the frothing officer now fallen into the ditch. As he lowered his spear, Apple's hand rose in an underarm throw, and an instant later the hilt of her knife jutted beneath his chin. He sat down, clutching his throat in confusion. The archer stumbled close by, blinded with tears and blood. Apple took up a dropped spear and ran it through the man's chest. Next, she went to offer mercy to the officer, now a twisting thing of mud and grass in the icy ditch water. She left him in a crimson bath and considered the two fallen Derns, Slapper and Robber. One had his face towards her and tracked the bloody tip of her spear with his eyes. Apple frowned, her gaze wandering to the tree line again, eager to be off. She had no stomach for killing helpless foes. In truth, she had no stomach for killing. She had always been a better teacher than a doer. Apple crouched. Sisters of discretion are supposed to pass unseen and be impossible to take unawares. She took two purple pills from her habit, brilliant groundwort. She had cured and prepared the roots herself, pressed the pills and sealed them in wax. "It's all very embarrassing. I won't tell if you don't." She peeled the pills quickly and popped one into the mouth of each man, then rolled them so they wouldn't choke. "If nobody finds you and kills you before you can move again, and believe me, you deserve to be found and killed, then my advice is to run all the way back to your boat." She wiped her hand on Slapper's cloak. The groundwort would make them sick for a week. A month, if they swallowed too much. She considered leaving her dagger in the spearman's neck, but went to retrieve it, pulling the blade free with a shudder of revulsion. In the next moment, she was moving, running for the trees, red blade in hand. Apple had always been a teacher first, lacking the iron for the darkest shades of grey work. Kettle, though, she would never fail to do what was required, without relish or complaint. A perfect weapon. When duty called her, she had the capacity to put her sweet nature in a box, ready for collection when the mission was complete. The thought of what it would take to get her to call for help made Apple shudder. Kettle would never willingly make Apple abandon the Abbess's orders. Arabella Jotza stood alone in the wild now, unwatched. Apple pressed on, using all her resolve to pace herself rather than to sprint. Miles lay ahead. She dodged around trees, following a deer track for a while, then leaving it to pursue a stream rotten with ice. Kettle had been watching Nona. Had something happened to the child? She was fearless, fierce, and quicker than thinking. But there were more dangerous things out in the corridor than Nona Gray. Perhaps it was Nona that needed help. Apple shook the thought away. The pain had been Kettle's. And the fear. A swirling fog came in, lifted somewhere by the moon's focus, and carried perhaps for days in the ice wind. The forest clutched at her, sought to trip her at every step, tried to lure her from her path with easier tracks. In the blind whiteness, Apple found her way, following the faint echo of Kettle's cry through the shadow. Many miles became few miles, and, as the fog cleared, became a singular remaining mile. The land had opened up into heath, where the soil stood too thin and too sour for crops. Farmsteads lay scattered, raising sheep and goats. Few houses stood close enough to see one from the next. Apple picked up speed, running now as she crossed rough ground, divided here and there by grassed-over lanes and collapsed walls of dry stone. Ahead the land dipped. In the broad valley a stream threaded its path between stands of trees before losing itself in a thicker extent of woodland. Kettle waited among those woods. Apple could feel it. Her nearness tugged at the scar her shadow cry had left. Apple slowed as she approached the first trees. She had been careless before. Her haste had delivered her into the hands of men she could have stepped around unnoticed if she had kept her focus. She moved between two elms and the shadows flowed around her, raised with both hands. Shade work had always come easy to her. Darkness pooled in her palms. When the shadows answered her will, it felt as if she had remembered some name that had long escaped her, or recognized the solution to a puzzle. A sort of mental relief, joy almost. Other shadow magic had been worked within the woods. The empty spaces shivered with the echoes of it. Kettle's cry lay there, sharp and deep. But other traces too. The sour workings of Noi Guin. Apple had tasted their like before, back at Sweet Mercy on the night Thurin Taxes had sent two of them to kill Nona. Quite how they had failed in that task was beyond her. Apple wrapped herself in darkness and sought the patience of the Grey Sister. Mistress Path had taught her the mantras 20 years ago, and Apple had made them part of her own foundation, woven through her core. Today, though, with Kettle's distress throbbing through the shadow, patience came hard. The undergrowth scratched and tore and rustled with each step Apple took. She felt as raw as any novice, her woodcraft rusty with disuse, certain that her advance would be heard by any foe within 1,000 yards. Bait the trap, a tactic as old as killing. Leave a comrade, a friend, a lover wounded, then wait and watch. A Noi Guin could be resting among the branches of any tree, crossbow ready, bolt envenomed. Kettle wouldn't have called me if that were true. Apple advanced, leaving patience behind her, but bringing the shadows. All that drew her eyes to Kettle was the bond between them. The nun lay at the base of a great frost oak, the length of her body fitting around the rise and fall of roots. Leaves covered her range coat, leaves and mud, her headdress gone, the spread of raven hair showing the paleness of her face only in thin slices. She lay sprawled like a dead thing, a part of the forest floor, a work of camouflage of which any Grey Sister would be proud. Kettle! Apple came to her side, the fear of an assassin's bow crushed beneath the certainty that Kettle lay dead, and that no purpose remained to her in the world. She took Kettle's muddy fingers in her own, shocked by the coldness of them.
Kettle, it's me.
She choked on the words, overwhelmed, while her other hand, still calm, sought the nun's pulse with practiced ease. Nothing. No. Not nothing. A whisper. Apple reached to pull Kettle to her, to lift her from the cold ground, but saw the hilt of the knife jutting from her side just above the hip. She touched a finger to the pommel, an iron ball. Leather binding wound the grip. She recognized the dagger. Kettle had shown one like it to her after it was confiscated from Nona. Noi Guin, for certain, then. The one that got away. Apple eased her lover onto her lap and sat for a moment, hugging her, eyes squeezed tight against the tears. Seconds later she drew a deep, shuddering breath and strove for calm. Think. Apple set Kettle back upon the ground and stripped her own range coat to lie her on. With Kettle arranged on the coat, she examined her for other injuries, checking the color of her skin, lifting an eyelid, listening to her breath, watching the speed with which circulation returned to her extremities when pinched. She took a thin leather tube from the collection within her habit and broke the seal. Already the cold was making her shiver. She tipped the liquid into Kettle's mouth, sat back, and watched. The knife was the only wound. It must have been coated with blade venom. But there were no strong indications to narrow down the type. For the longest minute in Apple's life, nothing happened. All about her, the trees groaned against the wind, their leaves seething. Then, Kettle twitched, spluttered, and started to choke. Apple seized her head. Easy! Just breathe. Any further question became lost in coughing and choking. One hand clutched at the range coat just above the knife.
Hurts. I told you to breathe, idiot. Appy?
Kettle rolled her head to see, eyes squinting as if the light were too bright. Her skin was bone white, lips almost blue.
Sister?
The faintest smile.
I've given you Adrene. It won't last long. Tell me what you've taken. Quick. Nola. She made me call.
Kettle slurred the words, staring past Apple at the leaves black against a white sky.
Gone now.
Apple shook her.
What did you take? It's important. But...
Kettle blinked, trying to focus.
Black cure.
Her breath came shallow and fast.
And kalewort.
Kalewort?
I was cold. Thought it might be nightweed on.
Who puts nightweed in blade venom? Apple shook her head.
Where's the assassin? Gone.
Kettle's eyes closed and her head flopped back. Apple bit her lip. The black cure should have had more effect whatever the Noi Guin had used. She tasted blood and frowned. Her mind lay blank. Nothing in her great store of lore suggested a cause or cure. Despair closed about Apple. Her lips moved, reciting venoms, none of which fitted the symptoms. Tendrils of shadow caught around Kettle, moving across her in wisps. Apple stared, her brow furrowed, mind racing. On the white inch of wrist exposed before Kettle's rangecoat swallowed her arm, a line of shadow followed the path of the largest vein.
No.
Apple motioned the shadows around her forward, and like a dark sea they washed over Kettle. As they drew back, traces of shadow remained, held by her veins as a lodestone will hold powdered iron, revealing the invisible lines of its influence.
Yes!
She grabbed Kettle's face in both hands.
Wake up! Kettle, wake up!
Kettle lay as boneless as the derns in the road. Apple slapped her.
Wake up! It was dark venom! I'm dead, then.
Kettle rolled her eyes open.
I'm so sorry.
A glistening tear pooled in the corner of her eye. She lifted a hand as if it were the heaviest thing in the world to Apple's cheek.
You're bleeding.
Apple took the fingers and kissed them.
You are my blood.
The darkness began to thicken around them, shadows streaming towards Apple, clotting about her.
What are you doing?
The smoothness of Kettle's brow furrowed, and her hand dropped back to her side.
Saving you,
Apple said. The effort of drawing so much shadow so fast tightened her voice. She felt a coldness in her bones, an ache behind her eyes.
How?
Kettle sought her eyes.
There's no way. There is a way.
Apple saw Kettle only because the darkness ran so deep in her. Night enfolded them both now. A fist of darkness within the depths of a forest grown lighter as its shadows were stolen.
I have to push you into shadow. No,
Kettle managed to shake her head.
The ancestor. I have to. It's the only way.
Apple gathered the darkness around her hands until even to her night-born sight they were holes cut in the shape of her body without depth or contrast. The Neuguin pushed the best of their killers into the shadow, as far as their minds could bear it. It broke some of them. Others were lost in the dark places behind the world. But the price Kettle feared to pay was her soul. The church taught that those who walk too far into the shadow would never join the ancestor in unity.
Don't!
Kettle lacked the strength to raise her hands again.
Sister Wheel, says the ancestor. Fuck Wheel, and fuck the ancestor!
Apple set one hand to Kettle's chest, kneeling above her, ready to push. She took the hilt of the knife in her other hand.
You're mine, and I won't lose you.
She bent her head, and tears fell.
Let me do it.
Her mouth twitched, and the words came out broken.
Please. Poisoner.
Kettle found the strength to raise a hand, running white fingers into the flame of Apple's hair. She held her a moment.
Poison me.
And with a cry, Apple pressed down with one black palm, all her strength behind it, and with the other drew the assassin's knife from the wound. Pulling with the steel and blood an inky venom born of the darkness that dwells between stars. Chapter 2 2 years later.
Have you come for the laundry?
The tall girl, a willowy blonde with a narrow beauty to her, stood away from her bed and bent to pull the linens from it. A titter ran among the other novices getting undressed around the room. Mystic class had the whole of the dormitory's second floor, and the beds were well spaced around the walls, with desks between them. Nona had been warned about Joelle Namsis. Her family held lands to the west and kept a close alliance with Thuron Taxis.
Yes, she said, and stepped forward quickly, taking the bundled sheets with Hunska swiftness.
She returned to the doorway and threw the bedding down the stairs. Across the skin of her back, Keote trembled with laughter.
Now, which bed is mine? Or must I take one?
Nona looked around at their faces, a dozen of them, variously astonished or horrified, a couple even amused. Of all the novices from Nona's time in Red Class, she was the first to join Mystic. Three of the girls from her time in Grey Class had reached Mystic ahead of her. Mally, a Hunska Prime who had been head girl, had a bed close to the door. Alata watched her, dark-eyed, from the far side of the room, a ritual patterning of her scars a black web across arms and cheeks. And Darla, who had joined the week before, grinning beneath the brown mop of her hair, the hugeness of her contriving to make the larger mystic beds look small.
Well, that was a mistake, peasant.
Joelle came to stand before Nona.
Mistakes are how we learn.
Nona looked expectantly past Joelle's shoulder towards an empty bed.
Perhaps I should teach you another lesson.
Joelle raised a hand, fingers spread. A white haze of lines filled Nona's path sight. Some said Joelle was the best thread worker in the convent, and since Hesse's death, Nona supposed it could be true. Using any kind of path power outside a lesson, however, was a surefire way to get your back shredded with a wire willow cane, no matter which family name you bore. Nona looked up, meeting the green slits of Joelle's stare, and spoke with all the sincerity she could muster.
I love you as a sister, and when we die, we will be together in the ancestor, our bloods mixed.
A warmth spread across her back as Keot sank into her flesh. A moment later he had wrapped himself around her tongue.
But I must warn you, sister, that a sickness runs in me, and if you fashion yourself my enemy, I will make a ruin of your life, for I am born of war.
Joelle stared at Nona, eyes widening as if recognizing a promise rather than a threat. Then laughter burst from her in a clean, controlled peal, confidence pushing aside sensible fear.
What dramatics! I am born of war!
Joelle mimicked Keot's words, accented heavily towards the peasant's dialect.
You were born of a mud hut in the wilds!
She glanced at her friends.
What a strange creature this novice is! I can see why Sister Half was keen to get her out of her class.
She turned away. Nona resisted the urge as Keot tried to make her arm rise to seize the girl's neck. Instead, she turned towards an empty bed with a snarl, angry at the lapse of concentration that had let Keot speak for her.
I will make a ruin of your life, Keot.
You should let me. That bitch means trouble for you.
Nona sat on the bed she had chosen, one of a pair too neat to belong to anyone. She pushed her small bag of possessions under the desk, spare clothes mainly. Joelle was already in animated conversation with three novices across the room, laughter and glances in her direction punctuating their conversation. A fourth girl returned from the stairwell with the sheets Nona had thrown.
If you kill one of them, the others will respect you.
Shut up.
The door opened again, and Zol walked in, arms folded across the bag she had brought from the grey dormitory. When Nona had left the classroom where Sister Hearth had examined her merit certificates, Zol had been waiting outside the door. They had both nodded acknowledgement, but it wasn't in the Ice Triber's nature to volunteer information.
Another one!
Joelle raised her voice in complaint. Zol's face registered no expression as she scanned the room, eyes dark above broad cheekbones. She wore her face like a mask. Nona could count on one hand the times she had seen her smile or scowl.
I...
Joelle seemed about to expand upon her displeasure, but for once, her supposedly forgotten aristocracy fell short, eclipsed by Zol's celebrity. Novices rose on all sides along with an excited babble of voices as they moved to welcome the Argatha. Nona decided against shielding her, though she was sure Zol would rather see the novices knocked down than endure their attentions. Zol made slow but sure progress towards the bed beside Nona, answering questions and flattery with curt nods. On the few occasions she did reply, she offered only single words, most of them, no. Outside the convent it was far worse. Her secret had been uncovered just months after they had returned from the ranging. Some said Shazal herself had spread the news, but whatever the truth, all of verity soon whispered that Zol was the foreblood spoken of in the Argatha prophecy, the chosen one, come to drive back the ice and bring salvation. And the rest of the Empire knew within another month. Pilgrims came to sit in vigil beyond the pillars even on days when the abbess stationed a sister at the base of the vinery stair to tell them there was no chance of an audience with novice Zol. Zol reached the bed and drove the last couple of novices away with a glower. The Argatha prophecy had been a constant in Sister Wheel's spirit classes for almost 3 years now, and she had managed to infect a fair proportion of the convent with her zeal, including most of the novices, at least the ones who didn't know Zol. "You're making friends almost as quickly as I am," Nona stood and stripped off her habit. Zol shrugged. "None of them are bleeding. Nona knelt to dig in her bag for her nightdress. Keote could sink from view for a few moments and knew enough not to be seen. Nona had explained to him that the nuns would seek to burn him out before throwing her from the convent over a cliff if she were unlucky. Nobody, tainted by a devil, could stay in service to the ancestor, even after the taint had been driven from them with hot irons. Sister Wheel's lessons had left no room for doubt on that account.
"Welcome to Mystic, Schwimp."
Darla came to the foot of Nona's bed, somewhat comical in her tent of a nightdress, her arms thick with muscles straining out of short frilly sleeves.
"Nice entrance."
"I do my best." Nona stepped out of her underskirts and pulled her own nightdress over her head as fast as possible. In Grey Dorm, they mocked her for being shy, but it was Keote who prompted the haste. Also, she was shy.
"She threatened to kill Joelle before she'd even reached her bed," Darla said to Zole. "And she didn't even have a crowd trying to get in her way."
Zole looked up from her bag, one hand wrapped around a carved tooth of some sea monster.
"Good. I do not like that, Joelle."
"You don't like anyone," Nona said. Zole shrugged. "Besides, I didn't threaten to kill her."
"I will make a ruin of your life,"
Darla quoted through a broad grin. "That's maiming at best," Nona said. "And I seem to remember my welcome to Grey wasn't too warm, either." Darla kept her grin.
"That was just a kicking. Joelle's a whole lot more dangerous. A thread worker can mess you up. And she doesn't even need to do that. She has lots of friends. Too many novices in this class are thinking they might not take their vows, just go back to their families. And when you start to think like that, you also start to think how helpful it is to have friends like the Namsis."
"Devil got my tongue," Nona said. "I should have held it more tightly."
"I spoke truth. The fortress of you is built of such moments. They are stones dropped into the well of your tomorrow."
"Shut up." Nona checked the bed for spiders and other welcome gifts, then slipped under the blanket, yawning. Darla laughed.
"Get your beauty sleep shield," she slapped the bed. "Long day tomorrow. You're with the big girls now."
All around the room, novices were climbing beneath thick blankets, Alata sleeping alone until Leany got her merit certificate in spirit, something Sister Wheel seemed to be taking particular pleasure in denying her. Joelle Namsis wore only her tawny skin to her bed, perhaps proud of her woman's body. Nona looked away. She would miss Ara's presence in the bed beside hers, close enough to reach out and touch. She yawned again and stared at the shadow dance across the beams above her. At heart, she was still a child of the Grey, and no matter how warm a room might be, she would never be at ease with nakedness, even in the bathhouse. Ruli had taught Nona the steam-weaving trick that she had first shown them at the sinkhole in the Focus Moon, and when possible, Nona wore a robe of steam around the bath pool. Keote hid across the sole of her left foot at such times.
"Shadows are nothing. Talk to me instead."
"Shut up."
"You should thank me. Your enemies make you what you are. Your foes shape your life more than friends ever could. This Joelle is good practice."
Nona ignored Keote and watched the shadows. Most novices with martial blood could make them dance to their own tune, but such tricks were put beyond her reach the day she cut her own shadow loose. The day she launched it at Yisht to try to save Hesse. She had failed. She had lost both her friend and her shadow, and Yisht had escaped with the Shipheart. Sleep came slowly as it always did, fighting to overcome the anger.
She finally fell asleep, wondering where her shadow might be now, and dreamed of being lost in dark places. Chapter 3.
In Mystic, we use edged steel.
Sister Tallow spoke to Zol and Nona above the clash of swordplay as the other novices sparred in widely spaced pairs across the sand of Blade Hall. She held two naked blades, forge iron rather than the arc steel of a Red Sister's weapon, but visibly sharp. Each had the same curve as a sister blade, and each was the same length, about as long as a man's arm from shoulder to fingertips.
There are some lessons that must be written in scars.
Sister Tallow offered the hilts. Nona took hers, clumsy in her new gauntlets. Like her new blade habit, the gloves were reinforced with strips of iron sewn into the padding. They wouldn't stop every hit, but they would lessen the chances of blood being spilled.
It's a good sword.
Zol swung hers, then circled a point in front of her. Nona lifted her own, finding it heavier than the blunted grey clasp blades. She felt awkward in her blade habit, as if she were wading in the bath pool. Red Sisters wore black skin, but that had been scavenged from the hulls of the ships that carried the four tribes to Abath, and was worth more than its weight in gold. Far more. An experienced Red Sister had to die or become a holy before a new one could get her armor.
You two spar. I'll watch.
Sister Tallow pointed to a clear patch of sand.
No showing off. We have serious and dangerous work ahead of us, and I would rather send you on to holy class with the same number of fingers and eyes you had when you arrived in Mystic.
Nona squared up to Zol. The Ice Triber stood as tall as Sister Tallow now, her gerant blood perhaps starting to show. Nona remained a head shorter. She supposed she was around 15, but when she came from the village she had scarcely realized there were dates, and certainly hadn't known on which one she had been born.
"What are the rules?"
Nona asked. Behind her thoughts, Keot yammered for blood and made his opinions on rules quite clear.
"No killing thrusts!"
Sister Tallow stepped back.
"That's it?"
Nona had no more time for inquiry. Zol pulled the mesh mask over her face and moved to attack. Nona pulled her own down and lifted her sword. Zol came in fast as she always did, offering no quarter. Sister Tallow never had to lecture the girl on controlling her temper. Nona wasn't sure Zol had one. Ara said if they cut the chosen one open, they'd find ice at her core. Nona's world narrowed to the flickering of blades and the clash of iron. With her speed matched, Nona had to rely on training, on the memory that Sister Tallow had imprinted on her muscles. Deeper than that, even, on her bones. She mounted a desperate defense against the stronger girl, acutely aware that the edge she met with her own could open ruinous wounds, even slice a limb off, gone in the blink of an eye, beyond repair. Zol would hardly care if she took all four fingers from Nona's sword hand at the knuckle.
Stop!
Sister Tallow raised an arm. Nona put up her blade, relieved.
Your fear is beating you.
Sister Tallow pinned Nona with her narrow eyes.
Zol doesn't even have to try.
I'm not afraid.
A snarl. And a lie. Bladework held a fear for Nona that was absent when she fought empty-handed. Perhaps it had started with Raymel Taxus swinging his sword at her as exhaustion robbed her speed. Perhaps before. Against most novices, bladework was just a game. But facing Hunska Primes and Fullbloods, her control slipped away, and slaughterhouse images crept in.
"Find your center, novice! Wear your serenity like a second skin!"
Tallow motioned for them to continue. Nona scowled and raised her blade. Serenity had never helped her find the path. It had been passion that led her there. Rage! On the blade path suspended high above the ground in the chamber behind the changing room, it had been the discovery that she needed to slide rather than stick that made her stop falling. Where the other novices stepped with ever greater caution, Nona had raced